Charlie Parker spearheaded the biggest revolution in jazz, bebop. Though not single-handed by any means, Bird was not only an intelligent, brilliant musician, but an absolute monster on alto sax. No one I've met or read speaks as informed and passionate as Dr. Garth Alper, jazz pianist and director of the University of Louisiana here at Lafayette. You're listening to Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS. This is Passport to Modern Jazz, and I'm your host, Djamma Gagne. Alto saxophonist Charlie Yardbird Parker was the leader of the biggest revolution in jazz called bebop. We have on the show today someone who can speak to his enormous contribution to American art, our own Dr. Garth Alper, jazz pianist, composer, and the interim director.
Director. No more interim.
Excellent. Hang on. Director, department head of the School of Music here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Dr. Alper has had several articles published on the subjects of jazz, popular music, and postmodernism in music. But I also want to quote Dr. Alper on our own ultoday.com. I'm a jazz musician by training, but I also spent quite a few years playing pop music, any gig I could get. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Djamma. It's good to see you.
Good to see you. Please share with us some of your personal insight on Bird and discuss your Charlie Parker playlist.
Well, you know, you said it, you know, as far as being one of the most important artists of the 20th century, you know, whether in any art form, musical or non-musical, and jazz or not jazz, this is someone who, in my mind, ranks up there with, and I think relates pretty well to someone like Picasso, you know, someone of that importance, someone who changed the music world just to a great extent. And, you know, there's no doubt that what he did, he built upon what came before him. You know, a lot of people have said that if you take Charlie Parker solos and you slow them down, they sound like Lester Young. And I think that's important to give that credit. But Parker also took it to the next level. And his brilliance, his ingenuity in harmony and melody, and also in emotion, in expressing emotion through instrumental music, which is just something that, you know, I don't know, that's something that reaches me, that touches me. So that's why whenever when I used to teach combos or even in my lessons, my current jazz piano lessons with students, I just have to talk about that because, you know, it's what inspires me. He's one of the great, you know, inspirations for me. So I just, hopefully you can share a little bit of that with other people.
Well, just thanks for giving that to our listeners. You're preaching to, the choir when you're talking to me. Yeah. I thought the same thing coming in to do this. It was like covering this man is just so, it might as well be Mozart. He influenced American art so much. I mean, he's an icon for the American poetry scene, beat poetry. I mean,
well, I agree. You know, and you know, you make the reference to Mozart, and Mozart was, you know, one of the giants of European music, and you had all these great Europeans when Europe was an important world force, and then in the 20th century, America became this important world force. America became, you know, economically and, you know, a military force. And with that often comes the arts. You know, when a country dominates like that, the arts often come up with it. And in America, it was African American music and jazz that, as part of that, that became one of the dominant forces. And Parker was one of those people that kind of represented America to the world. I mean, but through art and not through the military, which I think is something important to think about too. That, you know, when you read history books, you know, we talk about, you know, its military power, its economic power, but really, you know, it's been argued and people have said it a lot more eloquently than I can that the worth of a civilization, you know, may be art as opposed to money and power. And Charlie Parker was one of the most important people. He brought new ideas to, he approached the saxophone differently, approached melody differently, he approached harmony differently, and his not only did he build upon what came before him, but so many the artists in the 40s and 50s, the 20th century up to today, have built upon what he's done.
I wanted to ask you a question about
his influence, because sometimes people will hear some of his music and it sounds it might be a little bit dated. What in contemporary, when you hear modern contemporary jazz like Snarky Puppy or our own band Astro Project, and it's not that they don't know a lot of Birdheads, but what you hear in fusion, what are you hearing it from his influence?
Well, I mean, I hear that often, that, you know, it has somewhat of a dated sound. And I just disagree with that. To me, it has a completely modern sound. I mean, I hear Charlie Parker and the angles and the colors in the music speak to a contemporary sensibility as much as they do to an older sensibility. Now, when you listen to the recordings, some of the recordings aren't as clean as you'd hear now in the digital world. And some of the microphones, some of the taping techniques weren't as clean. But the music, to me, doesn't sound dated. I mean, to me, the music sounds edgy, and it still sounds fresh to me. I mean, and maybe that's just my own, I don't know, maybe that's my own academic viewpoint, but I don't hear it as sounding dated. And when I hear like Astral Project or Snarky Puppy or any of these, you know, more contemporary groups, yeah, you know, the instrumentation has changed somewhat. There's, you know, more, some more electronic instruments, but I still hear, I mean, even though, and even, you know, the rhythmic underpinnings of the music has changed, to me, they're still feeding on Parker and some of the older jazz styles. I mean, if you talk to, you know, the people in Astral Project, they, you know, they just talk about their inspiration from all types of music, from Bach to Parker. So I don't know. I don't. People do say it sounds dated. I don't know. I think if it sounds dated, you need to go and dig harder and listen harder to it and hear that he's speaking to us, you know, our contemporary society, as much as he was, you know, back in his time in the 40s.
So tell us about this first cut on your list. And I know this list can, you know, and I don't know what your favorite tune right now might be, but the first tune is Confirmation. Can you give the audience and musicians a little bit of an intro on this song?
Sure. You know, in not to get too technical, but it's an AABA form, which means you have a certain amount of measures, like 8 bars, then those repeat. There's your 2 A's. Then you get a contrasting section, the B section, and then it comes out back to the last A section. But that's just the harmony that's AABA. On this tune, each time he plays the A section, it's a different melody. And some people have said that Parker tunes sound like improvisation. And yes and no. I mean, to me, it does sound like it's improvised. But once you listen to it a few times, you start to hear the logic in it. And you start to hear the logic in it as a piece of music, as opposed to an improvised piece of music. And I need to clarify, because Parker was at such a level as an improviser that his improvisations had logic to them, and all the great improvisers had logic to them. So he was able to, like in the melody, the head of the tune, there's something that holds it together even more than an improvisation, but it also does have sort of a flowing sense to it. Like it's not something, it doesn't sound like he sat down and wrote it out with a pencil. It sounds like it's something that he heard in his head. And it's just one of the, you know, it's real easy to fall into traps and say, oh, it's a great tune, it's just wonderful, but it is. And I just like hearing it, so that's why I wanted to play it. Thank you.
So, Dr. Alper, tell us about this.
You can call me Garth, really.
Yeah, I do. it's just Charlie Parker, you know. It's just such a... He's just so heavy, man. You know what I'm saying? This tune, Blues for Alice. Yeah. What are you hearing this tune? What are you hearing?
Well, it's amazing. You know, it's like, you know, we know the blues inside and out. We've been hearing the blues in popular music for, I don't know, 80, 100 years at this point. And it's a blues, you know. And if you were to put this on your, you know, on your stereo and listen to it, it doesn't sound like a blues right off the bat. And that's because he took those 12 bars. He found a few signposts harmonically in it, but he found an incredibly inventive way to get to those signposts, the first bar, the fifth bar, and I don't know, I want to say off the top of my head, the 10th bar is where he's coming back around to where the chords would normally be. But he found these chromatic patterns, these chromatic 2-5 patterns to get to those signposts. And because of it, it sounds more like a bebop song than it does, say, a traditional blues. And then so there's this weaving around to get to those signposts. And then on top of that, within a solo, there's another weaving around the chord. So there are all these different layers going on. And just before, you know, you asked me that question, we heard a little bit of it. And it strikes me again that, you know, when he wanted to, he could, you know, dazzle with his technique. But when he wasn't dazzling with his technique, there was such a feeling to the music. I mean, there still is a blues feel to it, despite the great intellect. You know, that's what music is. You know, it's got intellect, it's got soul, it's got, you know, feeling, it's got, you know, what else is there, you know?
Well, feel around here, you know. Yeah, you got to have feel around here.
Exactly.
You know, when you get to a blues change, just some jazz people don't probably hear like Parker and his original feel for these things. They're so sophisticated, but the feel is like you say, is just so much still there.
Well, that's said perfectly. You know, there's sophistication and feel, and you know, you get all those elements and you put them together and you have great music.
When you have like a black man like this thinking that, well, you can play the blues, but I think he's the first one to think, you know, I can fit all 12 keys into this song if I know, you know, what comes, you know, how to get there and how to get out.
Well, that was the brilliance. I don't think he goes through all 12 keys, but he goes through quite a few, like maybe 6, 7, 8. And Parker was a great intellect. He was interested in all sorts of things. You know, I've read about him that he was interested in science and many of the different arts. And I know it's, you know, it's commonly known that he loved country western music too, because he thought they told great stories. He thought the lyrics told great stories. So he was intellectually very curious, as well as, you know, having the grounding in the music and studying, you know, a lot of the jazz that came before him as well.
Donna Lee. Tell us about Donna Lee.
Well, what I know about it, there was a pop song called Indiana or Back Home in Indiana, a very simple melody and, you know, standard chord changes. And as Parker did and a lot of jazz musicians did, they take the chord changes from another tune and write their own melody to it. And the melody that you hear on this is, again, one of those real snaky, convoluted, intricate melodies that played very fast. And at the time when, you know, Park would write some of these tunes, a lot of other musicians couldn't keep up with them. But it was sort of taking a piece of music that was there back home in Indiana, kind of putting his own stamp on it, making it new, just like jazz musicians would play the blues and take their own styles into it. And it's another great example of how intricate his melodies were and how he weaved melodies through the harmony and did it with such ease and did it at any tempo he could. And then, again, the melody sounds like that, and then the improvisation on this is just marvelous. It's just one of those things that, I don't know, I just smile when I hear it.
This was one of his, the contrafacts that he went, like, I know he got chased off stage a few times when he was young and in Kansas City, and he was said to, or he told Paul Desmond that he was, for about 3 to 4 years, he was practicing sometimes 15 hours a day.
Right.
To just keep up and play these songs. I guess some of them are like Cherokee, like in all 12 keys.
Yes.
In all 12 keys. I mean,
I've heard very similar things that for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years, he practiced about 15 hours a day. And, you know, I think that's telling about the level of skill that these, you know, the bebop players had, or the great bebop players like, you know, Parker, Gillespie, Roach, and all those guys. It's not something that, you know, it's not something, the talent to improvise, I mean, I think it takes a certain mindset to be able to improvise over music. I think it takes a certain, I don't know if it's a confidence or a certain, you know, I don't know. It's just a certain talent, but the talent is kind of meaningless because if you don't have the desire and the discipline to practice. And all those guys, Parker and Gillespie, and then later on, you know, there's stories of Sonny Rollins practicing, you know, his 12, 15 hours on the, I think it was the Williamsburg Bridge, and Coltrane, and all those guys just spent, you know, hours and hours and hours and hours, and just sort of, I think, points to the fact of what discipline it takes to get to that level of skill that these guys had.
I heard a story about Rollins, how he hated touring because it broke up his practicing schedule.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe that. Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think that compulsive need to practice is what sets some of these guys apart. You know, without it, you know, people couldn't keep up with them unless they were dedicated to, you know, their life had to revolve around their playing.
Climbing the next mountain.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's what each of these guys did. Parker and Coltrane, they all had their own mountains to climb, and they all had their own, you know, way of approaching the music, and you can hear it in their personalities because they had the skill to be able to express themselves.
Thank you.
Another blues, Donna Lee with the head. I don't know what musicians at the time, when they heard this with the blues changes, I can't imagine what they would have thought.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, and you know that's a great point because you know he was so you know, in some ways, he was so revolutionary and, you know, revolutionized the music that, well, I mean, we do know what some people thought. You know, some people, Louis Armstrong did not like bebop. I think Benny Goodman was a little bit more open to it. But some of the, I know Cab Calloway did not like it, you know. So some of the pop jazz players of the time were not happy with the direction that these guys took it. And they did take it in a new direction. And, you know, Au Revoir, you know, when I listen to that, you know, one thing that strikes me, you know, we've been talking a little bit about melody and harmony, but if you were to just take the rhythms there, just take the mm-hmm. rhythms of the head there and just play it without any melody and without any harmony, I mean, that would be difficult right there. I mean, it's very, very complex rhythms that are every measure, you know, he sets you up for a certain pattern, then he breaks it. So mm-hmm. it's sort of that, you know, the idea of building expectations and then sort of twisting your head around until you don't know what happened or what beat you're on.
That song is still fresh today as a blues tune. That great Pablo session, I guess that's from the 80s. But I mean, mm-hmm. even today, when you hear that as a blues head,
yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of what I was saying before is that, you know, to me the stuff sounds so fresh still, and you know, maybe that's just my own prejudice. And you know, maybe if someone who grew up in the, you know, was born 15 or 20 years ago, maybe, you know, it probably does sound dated in a certain way. But I think it's like any type of music or any type of art, you try to, you have to spend some time and study it a little bit. And really, by studying, it could just be a matter of listening, you know. And when we hear things that are new to us or not, you know, things that aren't familiar, they can sound funny. But if you just listen to it a lot and play it, and that's all I mean by studying.
Trying to
listen to it, and it can really then you can start to hear what's there. You know, I can't tell you how many different musicians over my life I've listened to and gone, nah, I'm not wild about that, and had sort of kind of closed-minded views about stuff. And then, you know, 5 years later I go back and listen to it and I go, oh wow. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's, oh, I really hear something there. And then I might listen to it more and go, wow, this stuff is incredible. This is amazing. And it just speaks to your own prejudices, you know. It's not like the music's bad. It's just that your own closed-mindedness about it. And I think, you know, anyone that listens to Parker and maybe hears, you know, you hear things, oh, it's just a lot of notes, it's overly intellectual, I just ask them to give it another chance, you know. Because I can't tell you, I've been in the position where I might have spoken badly about someone's music, then that person's music was on the radio, and I'm going, wow, this is telling somebody, wow, this is really great. Who's this? And it's someone that I've badmouthed, you know? So it's just sort of being aware of your own limitations, you know?
Just starts communicating to you.
Yeah, exactly. And it, sometimes it's just a matter of growing up, I think, and being open to different things.
Mon, and this music is so complicated. When you get to it, or you try and just figure out ahead, it's really, you know, it's a door you don't want to open.
Right.
I know as a guitar player, I mean, hey, these heads are really difficult.
It's very difficult. But even to someone who maybe doesn't even play an instrument, it just might be a matter of listening to it a few times before you start to hear the patterns and you start to hear the music in it. And so I don't know. I just trying to make a case of people keeping an open mind, like I have to tell myself to do, because I'm as good as anyone as, you know, making, you know, like making up my mind about something before I know enough about it.
Hey, again, you're preaching to the choir.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
here we have what they call another contrafact. Yeah, this
yeah.
is rhythm changes. Moose the Mooch.
Exactly.
And I believe we won't get into all the, he was so excessive. I mean, he's just such a big liver. He had a big liver. Well, it wasn't big enough. But Moose the Mooch, and this was his connection in New York.
Yes.
Right? So he wrote a song to him. I don't know what he got out of it, but what a great tune. Mm-hmm. Tell us something about this tune. You've played this tune many times.
Yeah.
And again, some of these songs, all you need to take is like one of Parker's licks, just one of his lines, and you've got years of study.
Well, I agree with that. And, you know, that's how he studied, too. He would take, you know, different ideas and work them around all 12 keys, you know. And, you know, I agree with you that his ideas were just so, you know, just so musically interesting that you can take an idea and look at it from a lot of different angles, like look at his melodies from so many different angles, from a sense of contour or texture or how it works with the harmony. There are just many different ways of looking at it. And like you alluded to earlier, this is a tune that was written on a previous set of chord changes, George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, you know, and jazz musicians, just like they loved the blues, they loved this tune too. And, you know, there are hundreds and probably thousands of tunes that have written on the same chord changes. But when you listen to Parker, this is a tune that, like I said on earlier, some of his tunes sound a little bit improvised, but if you listen to him, you start to hear the logic behind it. This one, you almost hear the logic right away. Some of them really did sound like this was a statement that he was trying to make and more than improvisation in the head. And again, real interesting rhythms in it, real interesting melodic ideas. I don't know what else to say. You know, I forget who it is that said it, you know, like, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. You know, you're trying to express yourself, express what you think about another medium, and maybe it's just best to listen to Parker play it instead of trying to figure out how to explain it.
So we all get into tunes this semester. I know you don't have a lot of time to play with your new position and all, but what tune are you really into right now by Byrd? Are you examining or playing or got as a favorite for playing right now?
Well, you know, I still, you know, one tune I like giving my students is Au Provence. It's a tune that harmonically, you know, someone who hasn't been playing a whole lot can grasp pretty well. But again, it's got that, you know, it's a lot harder than it sounds when you hear it. So that's a tune I always love playing. I always love Donna Lee. I love Confirmation. All these tunes here are sort of, you know, tunes on gigs I used to play a lot, so it's always fun to go back to them.
So for young musicians that are the jazz musicians that are out there, or any musicians, we've got a lot of them here.
Yeah.
We are the underground live music capital.
Yeah,
right now around this, and for our listeners when they're listening to Parker or to rediscover Parker or to young listeners that are just students that really want jazz. I mean, what do you? How do you connect them to Parker? I mean, how do you just introduce them to him?
Well, that's a good question. You know, teaching jazz is a difficult thing in that you're trying to get students to forge their own path. You know, you want them to create something that maybe doesn't sound like it was taught in a university, because universities tend to mm-hmm. codify stuff so much. That sometimes if you're not careful in jazz, which is an improvisatory art, you can kind of I don't want to be too harsh here, but sometimes you can beat the creativity out of them, you know. But what you can do is point them in the right direction and hopefully watch them, you know, gain the love of the music, because without it they shouldn't be doing it. You know, if they don't have their own direction that they want to take it, then there's nothing wrong, you know, with someone who doesn't have that drive in learning about it. I have no problem with that at all. But if someone's serious about the music, they got to find their own direction themselves. And really, you know, one of the best things you can do as a teacher is just go, hey, give this a listen. What do you think? You know, and talk about it. Talk about the music. Maybe talk about what inspires you. But you can't inspire someone else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they're going to have to come to it themselves. And so that's always I always find that a tricky line in teaching jazz, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You want them, to create their own way, but at the same time, you got to lead them somewhat. You know, you got to show them what you know to help them figure it out for themselves a little bit.
Exactly. And what do you think Charlie Parker would have been if he wasn't an alto saxophonist and hadn't come up in rough Kansas City during that time? What do you think he?
I have no idea, but you know, I think in the time, I think one reason why there were so many great African American musicians at the time is because they didn't have many other choices. So when you had a brilliant mind like Parker, there weren't a lot of avenues for him to go to, but music was one that was accepted. And who knows if he, you know, grew up, in our time, or maybe, you know, 50 years from now. Like I said, the guy was a brilliant guy. I think he could have gone in a lot of different directions, but I guess we're fortunate no matter what that he did go into music and he gave us what he gave us.
We want to thank Dr. Alper for coming in and informing us of the great Charlie Parker. This is Charlie Parker special, and we're going to listen to a tongue-in-cheek bebop tune that Parker wrote called Ornithology. I guess this is like a study on the bird. We're going to play Ornithology and listen to some more of Charlie Parker here, and you're listening to KRVS 88.7 on your dial and KRVS.org here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Ornithology.
Thank you. Why, yes, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It brings back a lot of memories. Charlie Parker, the All-Stars, and we hope you enjoyed it.
And Charlie Parker won many postmortem awards, Grammys in 74, 88, 89, 95, and 2002. He had a 1984 Lifetime Achievement Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. And he was also, I Remember You and Parker's Mood were selected by literary critic Harold Bloom for a short list of 20th century American sublime, the greatest works of American art produced in the 20th century. Though many of us have a great love for Charlie Parker, a group of men that dedicated to themselves were some of the first call musicians around Los Angeles. They were just first call. They were on Pet Sounds and everybody's record in the 60s. Med Flory, Connie Condoli, Joe Lopez, Wayne Marsh, Jay Migliori, Jack Nimitz, Ronald Bright, Buddy Clark, Jay Canna, Frank Rosalino, a band that won Best Jazz Performance Grammy for 1975. And Wayne Marsh, God bless him, he died during a solo at Dante's in L.A. during his solo in Out of Nowhere. And that was the name of them was Super Sax, and they were dedicated to Bird. Let's hear some Super Sax.
ragazzo. Thank you.
Live in Japan, Super Sax. Are those guys in love with Charlie Parker? That's a lot of work to sit down and transcribe all of those heads back then and then harmonize them for a saxophone section of and brass, with brass, with trumpet and trombone too. Just an amazing band. Well, this has been the Charlie Parker Special, The Man. He lived from August 29th of 1920 and died March 12th, 1955. The King of Bebop, Charlie Parker. It's been a pleasure presenting his music. This is Passport to Modern Jazz. I'm your host, Dejan Magagne.
Hi, this is Lee Kleinpeter with an invite to join me Thursdays at noon on KRVS 88.7 for Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Elvis, Carl Perkins, even Dolly Parton.
Hi, this is Diego Martin Perez inviting you to join me for La Bayonera Latin Music for Acadiana Thursday at 7 p.m. only here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, or via the web on krvs.org. Ay, qué rico.
Hey, she's heavy.
Jamaican guitarists sing musical visions. James Brown impersonator. Fela Kuti himself. Join me, Georges Collinet, for this and more on this week's edition of Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Folks, fire up those grills for the last long weekend of summer, and whatever you're grilling, rubs and marinades only enhance flavor, so don't forget those seasonings. Join me, Chef John Foltz, and Meathead Goldwyn, grilling guru of the internet, as we talk about rubs and marinades on Stirring It Up, coming up this Saturday at 5 p.m. right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
If one goes back, an error, or even two errors before Charlie Yardbird Parker, in Louisiana, jazz is starting up, and at that beginning is Bunk Johnson.